from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny, who's on vacation. Taylor Mack was raised in Stockton, but that seems a long time ago now. After more than two decades in New York and the careful cultivation of an onstage persona that almost defies definition, a politically charged version of King Lear's fool in drag, or playwright, performance artist, self-professed radical liberal queer? Well, we have Taylor Mack in studio to answer that question. Thank you so much for being here.
I love that carefully defined that's undefinable.
So, I mean, you know, how would you define it? I mean, surely people must ask you the question all the time. Who are you? What do you do?
I'm just really a theater artist. You know, I think it's that kind of simple, but we're in our 20th century education of what a theater artist was has led us to this point where most people are just kind of one thing. And so I'm just working off of the tradition that's a little bit older than that, where everyone kind of does a little bit of everything, you know. So it's really that simple. But I do like to think of myself as a fool, you know, in the sense of, of like the person who is there to tell the people in power that maybe they're being a little silly, you know.
There is a deeply political bent to a lot of your work.
I'm interested in politics, and I think you should make work that you're interested in. That's the main reason why the work becomes political, is because I want the audience to see that whatever we're talking about, the person who's making it is passionate about it. So then, because I'm passionate about what's happening politically in the world, it ends a lot. Politics end up in the work a lot. And also, you can't. If you're not paying attention, if you're not talking about politics, you know.
I mean, well, I think certainly for this audience, you are speaking to kindred spirits who feel engaged with the world and want to hear somebody who's been thinking about it, say something about it. I'm going to have you describe what it is you're doing at the Curran Theater
because
I think you can do it better than I can.
We're making a big 24-hour concert. I've been working on it for about 4 years now, and we still have another 9 months of work on it. It is the history of popular music in the United States from 1776 to 2016. What we're doing at the Curran is just the first 6 hours. So the first week we're doing three-hour performances of Act One of the piece. There's eight acts, and then the next week we're doing two 3-hour performances of Act Two, and then the final performance we're going to do all both Act One and Act Two back to back, which is 6 decades, so 6 hours.
So this is like a giant dress rehearsal for a marathon performance, kind of like, I don't know, The Ring.
I'm essentially marathon training for it. So we do these 3-hour shows, and then we do 6-hour shows, and we've yet to do a 12-hour show, but we're going to do that pretty soon. So I'm just trying to figure out how does it all piece together. And ultimately, there's 246 songs in the show, which San Francisco this time around is only going to get to experience 60. Only 60 songs.
I think that might be enough, at least this time around. We wanted to play a little clip of you talking about performance art from one of your shows, if you don't mind.
Sure.
In a performance art concert, you can be disturbed, annoyed. You can hate every single moment. You can hate me. You can just hate the entire experience, and I still will have succeeded. It is the genius of performance art. There is no failure.
Those are big words. I have been to some really bad performance art.
Of course.
Can you convince me that, you know, that this trip to the Curran Theater is worth it?
Well, that's the thing about, a lot of performance art isn't very aware of itself, but you could say that about musical theater as well, or, you know, any kind of art. And my work is really about homogeneity and heterogeneity and what is that conversation? I grew up in a place where everyone kind of had to be one way and was expected
Stockton.
To. Yeah. And everyone was expected to adhere to a certain kind of class system and a certain kind of just social etiquette and social dictate. And I,
And so the idea that we could be multiple things, not just one nation under one God, but, you know, that we could have – we could express the full range of who we are is the kind of stuff that I'm interested in my art. So when I do my performance art, it's there's some earnest quality to it because that's part of who we are. But it's also ridiculous, and it's serious, and it's deep, and it's political, and it's just entertainment, and it's messy and professional and polished and improvisational and rehearsed, and so it's everything. I'm trying to express everything that there is. So that's why I think I think that's why it works. I mean, I'm allowing it to be everything instead of just one thing.
Yeah. Well, obviously, you have to make some choices, even in a 24-hour marathon review of American music. You're going to have to pick, you know, one song here and one song there.
Yeah.
What did you pick and why?
Well, first off, I'll say that it's my subjective 24-decade history of popular music. It is, and I'm not a historian, so I'm not really – I'm interested in history. So, again, that history is part of the show, but it's not really about history.
It's like a sampler platter.
Well, it's more like where – years ago, when I was 14, 15 years old, I went to the very first AIDS walk that was in San Francisco. And the first time I ever saw an out homosexual, it was thousands of them all at the same time. And it was a pretty profound experience. And the reason they were all gathered is because the community was being destroyed by the epidemic. So the community was both being built as a result of being destroyed. And I found that really interesting. And years later, wanted to make a show about it. And so this is actually my version of that experience, which is I'm going to put myself through an experience of performing for 24 hours. I'm going to be falling apart. The audience is going to be falling apart. But as a result of all the stuff that we do and the onslaught of history, we actually are creating bonds with each other and building some kind of connection amongst each other. So that's the real thrust of the show. So the show really isn't so much about which song is the most popular or what exactly happened here in this history. It's more about what's happening in the room with the people and using the songs as a vehicle to get to that.
Yeah. Well, I know we have a lot of listeners who have seen you on stage performing or are curious about it. Join the conversation. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, tweet to @KQED Forum, post on our Facebook page. You can join the conversation that way. We thought we'd play a little bit of music to give people a sense of what you sound like singing on stage. This is a song called You Love Me.
You love me not, you love me, you love me not. How you could love me, why would you not love me? Does he care for me, or does he not? Is he fair to me? What have I got? Why does he love me? Why does he not love me?
I feel like I've just been transported to some smoky cabaret room.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, thinking about past loves and what went wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's actually a song from a show of mine that I did here in San Francisco called The Lily's Revenge. And I'm dressed as a flower, and the person who's singing with me is torn off all my petals. So it's very tongue-in-cheek at the same time. This is what I mean by the heterogeneity of it. It's both tongue-in-cheek, but it's also has some real depth to it as well, and sadness, and so you're watching something that you feel the juxtaposition of it is conflicting and enriching for me, anyways. I mean, that's the kind
and,
of
and you have
I like.
Some ironic sense, you know, that you can't just hit things head on.
And, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I try to – sometimes I do hit them just head on. Sometimes I take that hammer and I pound that head down with it, you know, with it. And then in the very next moment, we do something that's very subtle. So it's really a juggling performance that is happening.
every single show is different because we rehearse and we do them and we get up and at least 20% of the show is improv. So it always is changing every night and we change up the songs and we've got, I think at the Curran here, we've got 9 musicians on stage with us. So it's a big group of people.
And, you know, one of the people who may not be on stage is incredibly influential in the ultimate look and feel of this. Can you tell us what you'll be wearing as a function of your work with Machine Dazzle?
Yeah, Machine and I have been working together for over 10 years now, and he's my costume designer for the piece, and he's kind of a mad genius, and he's making a different outfit for every decade. And, you know, what he does is he'll research the decade and he'll say what was invented in the time, and somehow all of those end up in the piece. So an example might be when we do our 1846 to 56 decade, it's Stephen Foster songs and Walt Whitman's poems, and we mash them up together, and they kind of battle it out to win the title of Father of American Song. And Machine discovered that potato chips were invented. So the entire outfit is made out of potato chip bags, you know. So like setting up, they're smelling like sour cream and onion potato chips. But and then he'll create a silhouette from the time.
Does the audience get to eat part of the costume afterwards?
Yes. No. I don't think you'd want to.
So what did Machine do with 1776?
He created this look that is quite fabulous. He went to an old car wash, you know, and got those flags that, you know, he just had this concept that sometimes he'll research and the outfit will become this thing that is stuff that was invented, material that's not fabric and things. And then other times he'll just have an idea. And so he wanted to create a kind of character look for me of somebody who ran a 1776 car wash. Like, what was that? You know, so it's quite fabulous.
I can see how it could work. I mean, you know, why not? It seems in many ways like your work just embraces the spirit of fun and experimentation You know, go big or go home.
Yeah. I mean, we're really trying to mash up what is going on right now in the world with what was happening then. And also, we're telling it from a queer perspective, you know, that we didn't ever learn queer history in the public school system. No one ever mentions it a single time. You know, you learn about everything a little bit in our history, but you don't learn anything about the queers. And I think that's changed a little bit in some places. But,
especially here in California.
Even probably not in Stockton, you know. So even just an hour away is probably not being taught. So you know, part of the fun of this show is like, where did we exist? Where are we? You know, well, maybe it's not in the history books, but let's talk about this a little bit, you know.
So what is it like coming back here to San Francisco, which maybe wasn't your hometown, but certainly a place that was huge in your formative years for what it represented?
Oh, yeah. I mean, San Francisco, it feels like my second home to me. And so it's a dream. And to be – I don't know if you've seen that stage, that Curran Theater. I mean, what Carol Shorenstein Hayes is doing there is just extraordinary. It's so I would go see the Broadway touring shows when I was younger there, you know, and so to get to like perform on that stage is so much fun. And the audience sits on the stage in the series because the theater's under construction. So it's called the Under Construction Series. So they're booking all the stuff that's kind of being built in front of you while also the theater is kind of being built. But they're not doing construction on the stage. So the audience sits on the stage and you look out at the house, which is a very rare experience for an audience to experience what the performer is looking at usually. It's pretty neat.
Do you have a sense of what the audiences look like these days? Who's looking back at you from the seats?
You know, it always is different depending on the venue and depending on how much they're connected into their own community and how wide and stuff. So sometimes it's all white people. Sometimes it's really diverse. Sometimes it's all queer people. Sometimes it's all straight people. It just really depends on where I am. My preference is for it to be really mixed up because all different types of people teach each other how to listen to a show. If it's an entire queer audience, sometimes I'll say something that's maybe a little sad, but I know that they're all going to laugh, and they all laugh. Everyone laughs.
And is that true across generations? Like, San Francisco is a city that pulls in many, many different waves of gays from all over the world.
Uh-huh.
And you know, things change. You know, the experience of somebody who came here in 1982 is going to be different from the experience of somebody who came here in 2002.
Yeah. I think the older queers are a little more cynical, and the younger queers tend to be a little bit more a little tighter. You know, like they're not as loose as that's my bias. You know, I mean, I do have that. I do kind of feel that way. But I think that's true in general. I think that that the younger generation is trying to figure out how to exist in a world where their decisions are all made publicly. You know,
you know what yes, I mean? Personally, yeah. privately, and yeah. politically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So of course, they've gotten a little tighter than my generation and the generation above me certainly was, where it was like, yeah, we could make our mistakes because we were in some basement bar and nobody was going to tweet about it, you know?
Well, we definitely want our listeners to tweet about it and shout about it. And don't let me hug this conversation, folks. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786. What questions do you have for Taylor Mack before the show opens on Thursday? 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's listen to another song and get a sense of what it is you do on stage.
To feel and flow, to grow. What we are told, and I was destined to the same, to loathe and languish as my love is tamed, to wilt away as cameo, to be reborn but to tiptoe into an unrequited life. Well, I will break this cycle rife with what I can and cannot be. I'll flower.
Sounds so legit singing.
It does.
Now, well, that was very musical theater-y, that one.
what does that mean exactly?
Well, there's different types of singing, you know, and some of them are... It's all just really has to do with tone and vowels and what kind of... It's that thing of... This is so much about what a 24-decade history is, because that song that you just heard is not from the show. And what I'm really interested in doing is figuring out how do you not try to touch the hem of God when you perform. And what I mean by that is how do you not reach for perfection? Instead, how do you try to reach the people? You know, so when you're trying to have a good tone, then you sing a certain way. Everything is on pitch and clear and, and certain it's more in the opera style or the musical theater style of singing. And they call it a legit sound in the industry. But
there is a value to being on pitch.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But some of my favorite singers can't sing, right? You know, isn't that interesting that Nina Simone, who can sing, but often chooses to just be above or below the pitch? She doesn't care. She's trying to tell a story. And it makes it better because she does that. Or someone like Patti Smith, who just screams everything, you know? It's
right.
Like, it's better for some reason, often. Not
Maria
always.
Callas,
Maria
name an
Callas
opera singer,
would sometimes
often
go off
criticized
pitch.
Yeah, for doing it her way.
Yeah, because she wanted to tell a story. That was the most important thing, is to risk your humanity. So it's something that I really try to focus on with the 24 decade, is how can I reach the people rather than reach for God? Which, and sometimes you reach the people by reaching for God, and I get that, but it's a different approach to performing, which is exciting, and I'm figuring out.
Presumably, you didn't leave the womb with a voice this big and grand and versatile.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you learn to sing? How did you learn? Who did you seek out?
Well, I took voice lessons for years. But really, this what I'm doing now is primarily comes from just gigging. You know, it's so much about every night doing it, night after night after night after night, you know. And I really cut my teeth in the clubs in New York City. So that's where, I mean, my first professional job was in Beach Blanket Babylon in San Francisco when I was 19. So,
what was that like?
It was a really good experience for a young person to figure out how to sustain a performance over 8 months. I was in it for 8 months, you know. And so that was that's a great foundation to get. And it ultimately was not for me because I was interested in politics and, you know, and also writing my own material and going out there. So I wanted to do a different kind of art. But that the sheer joy of that show is definitely something I love, you know.
And gosh, so much time in New York, which is a totally different scene, and I imagine in many ways just an audience that has a hunger for theater of all kinds, a willingness to experiment with you.
Yeah, you know, and it's here too. I that's the fun thing I think about what the internet has done for us is it's given us access to all different types of people and styles and forms and content And when I was growing up in San Francisco, if you wanted to be a theater artist, you really kind of needed to move to New York. You know, that was it, yeah. At least. And now that's not so true. You can really make the work here and stuff. It is true that New York has more of a culture where people come there in order to see work. And it definitely has more of
There's
just more of everything.
Do you really feel it seems like your own career, you have been off-Broadway, off-Broadway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, you've done every different level of theater. It just seems to be such a much bigger ecosystem.
Yeah, and healthier. And I was just talking to my musical director who's arranging 246 songs and stuff. And we were talking about how it really feels kind of like a golden age of performance right now because people are able to make it themselves more. What's happening is this presenter world, like what's happening at The Curran, where the artists are making the work and then the producers and the presenters are finding those artists and then supporting them to come to the theaters, as opposed to people making work so that a producer will to a commercial run of it necessarily. So it's the art is becoming first and foremost what's important. And it's actually what's getting you attention instead of the ability to adapt to norms, you know, which is exciting. It's an exciting time.
Well, let's take a call now. We've got Tim in Berkeley. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. I'm loving to hear about your success. I'm also from Stockton. I left there in 91 just judging from what I've heard you say about it so far, it doesn't sound like maybe you maintain a lot of connections or go back there. I know I don't. You don't have to be gay to not want to go back to Stockton. I don't go back, but I look at other folks, you know, Chris Isaacs from Stockton, and he does go back, he does give back. And I'm wondering, knowing how you came up and what's Stockton like, if you feel a need or an obligation to reach out and to try to make some change to this place that, you know, generally most of us leave behind.
Yeah, I do actually, and I wrote a whole play about it. It's called Here, and we did it at the Magic Theater. Loretta Greco, the artistic director, supported that play and produced it in San Francisco. We premiered it here, and it just had a production in New York that was a nice hit for us. It was quite lovely and a great production. And they, but that play is specifically addressing that issue of what do? You leave home. And then if all the interesting people leave and then the statistics never change, it still ends up being, you know, one of the highest, places in the country that for illiteracy and the murder capital of America, you know, periodically every
are
year
your parents
or,
still
every
there?
Few years. No. In fact, I only have there's only a couple people that I still know that live there. So it really has changed in that way. But it hasn't changed so much in terms of its health. So I do feel like I have a responsibility to it. And at the same time, I also recognize that in order to thrive and grow and feel relatively safe, that I need to kind of, you know, move on and go to other places. So it's an interesting phenomenon. And I don't have the answer to it, but I have lots of questions and I'm trying to engage in that.
And perhaps thinking too of the generations coming up, you know, I mean, could be a young Taylor Mack just starving to see somebody like you.
Yeah. The difference is those young people have access to it now if they have access to the internet. So, and not all of them do. So we pretend they do, but they don't all.
Well, one person who does writes, what is this term queer? Queer means strange or bizarre, which gay people are not. It is highly offensive to imply that some people are queer. Indeed, heterosexuals are much more likely to be queer than gay people. Please do not try to use such an inaccurate and offensive term to apply to those of us who are gay. As a gay San Franciscan in my 30s, I know many hundreds of gay women and men, and I have never met and never hoped to meet a queer person.
Oh, well, that's sad because I would hope that you would want to meet me. I am a queer person. And what I would say is that, and this is what my friend Penny Arcade says, is that a queer is not a gay or a straight person. A queer is a person who is ostracized by society as a young person to such a degree that they don't want to ostracize anyone else. So if you don't want to meet a queer person, that would mean that you're not queer. That means if you define yourself as gay, that means you're gay. And I think that is the difference between a gay person sometimes and a queer person, is that someone who doesn't want to identify as queer is struggling. They're struggling with their own stuff. You know, I don't want to judge that. You know, I think I have plenty of friends who wouldn't identify as queer, but I do. I think it's a beautiful way of describing myself and most of my community.
Well, what a wonderful note to go out on. Taylor Mack, thank you so much for being here with us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Taylor Mack, singer, songwriter, and playwright. He's appearing in a 24-decade history of popular music at the Curran Theater opening Thursday. If you want tickets, get moving. We're going to leave with some music here so that you can hear what some of this sounds like. You've been listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
I think your great big city is very pretty, but nevertheless, I want to be there. I want to see there a certain someone full of charm. That's why I wish again that I were in Michigan, back on the farm. That's why I wish again that I were in Michigan, back on the farm.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.